Okay, now we're going to go into answer a question which came from a client relative to about all how we switch all these how we choose funds and so forth, and other things that are related to T theory, where we're talking about these why did we pick for example why do we pick four money flow indicators and we don't go any further than that. Rather than try to do money flow indicators for everything else. Well, that really comes out of the study that I did started doing after the year 2000. And in this part C presentation, which is the third part of today's presentation, I divided that into a couple of categories. The first one is the shock I had in the year 2000 when I had basically the 40-year cycle showed that there was a major top of the year 2000, and all of that growth stuff that we were doing for the for coming up because our program was started in 78. The company was started in 74. The management started in 78, and the question came up was when you got to 2000, all that growth stuff that we were doing was basically made irrelevant by the ultra-high price-earnings ratios that occurred during the dot-com speculative boom. And the first part of that one is that we have Robert Shiller, who is the professor at Yale, wrote Rational Exuberance, which is if you get the second edition, is very much worthwhile reading. And he did all, he what he did is he took the Graham and Dodd fundamental research that was done in the 30s on price earnings ratios and other ways of stock valuation, and did a first-rate job on it. It during the and he showed that the stocks were unsustainable at 2000, but even more than that, that peak in valuation was as great as 1929, and from the 40-year cycle, you got 20 years of bad road ahead of you. And all the things you learned coming up from up to 2000 were a waste of time because that market, that stuff basically was thrown out. So the question came up how to come up with something that was different and what could handle the problem of what did you do in the post-2000 environment. I would just mention now that Rational Exuberance second edition, you can get it from Amazon used, or you can get it from the library, but it's very much worthwhile having because it's got a lot of information in it. And if you get the second edition, you also get his take on the speculation, the outrageous speculation on real estate, and that's probably going to take another 20 years to get that taken care of. So if you're interested in real estate, it's probably worthwhile reading that as well. Then we move on to my spreadsheet, which is what we call a matrix, which is proprietary, but I'm going to read off some stuff from you, some of the conclusions, which is 64 about 65 columns by about 160 rows of spreadsheets classifying all sorts of investment alternatives, basically everything we could think of. And out of that pattern comes certain things that you can it's certain patterns that exist in the post-2000 period, which we expect to be generally somewhat true into the year 2020. And of course, one of those is the use of the VUSTX, which is n not the greatest investment for the first 2 years of a bull market, but it's the best fund to have, or a treasury bond fund is the best fund to have in the decline periods where you go down through what would be the 2 years going down to late 2012 or 13. And so I'm going to talk about that, and then I relative to and what the conclusion on that one is that you if the market's going up, you want high yield bonds, and if the market, well, first of all, if you don't want to do anything with stocks because they're overbought, what you want is bonds, and if it's an up market, you go with the high yield bonds for, on a conservative bond basis, and if the market is going down, you go into treasury bonds as a conservative basis. Then we also go into everything else, which would be all the growth funds that any fund that was had a plausible case, we track that too. And so I'll give you some comments on some of those. But generally speaking, you don't want to own them in a bear market because all the ones that were great going up are terrible going down. So that's where the T13 business comes. You're making the transition. You're refining it now, But in the end, you don't, there's a lot of things you don't want to have, and then the question is what to do on that. And then the other category of funds that we have are benchmarks. Some of the funds that we track are not practical to trade because they have 5% loads on them, and generally speaking, we don't. We deal only in investments that you can get in for a reasonable price. There are, the change that's coming out is that there are a lot of exchange-traded funds coming up now which can duplicate this, so it's even more reason why you don't have to pay the front load. But we do keep, independently, we keep what the best managers are, and what we try to do is make sure that American Shareholders stays competitive or ahead of any buddy that could be construed that has a long-term record. And so I will just talk about a little bit about those, but that comes under the case of benchmarks, which means that there's standards that you check because you're going to benchmark yourself against them, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to buy them. Okay, so that's an overview. So let's take the first part is going to be, let's talk about irrational exuberance by Professor Schiller of what he found, which is related to my 40-year cycle stuff, which I'm going to start getting into my tutorials on, that using the Graham and Dodd pioneers of definition, you take the earnings, you construe a earnings on a 10-year annual average basis, rather than just trying to say that the earnings were up this year or down next year, it's fungible and all that stuff. And then he adjusted them for inflation, and he concluded that the price earnings ratio for the S&P 500, which is the benchmark we use, was over 40, approaching 45. But if you look at the last century, you'd find out that those things are bad places to own common equities. And eventually they went under, by that definition, under 10, around 7, which I've discussed before in the archives. And when you think about that, going from above 40 to down to below 10, that means that stock market earnings over the next, from 2000 to 2020, are constant, you're going to have a case where people would pay 44 times as much at the top and only 1/4 as much at the bottom. And that kind of, that's called pre-yield compression. And so even if you take the best case of stocks holding in a sideways pattern as far as earnings are concerned, you can lose 75% of the value. So every $10 you have at 2000 could end up being 1/4 or $2.50 by the time you get to some place wherever the low is, which I think would be seen by the year 2020. So that's PE compression. So it doesn't pay any attention. There's no sense in asking what the earnings are going to be. It's the PE ratio that's going to compress you. And if you ask them why is the PE ratio compressing, it's because they have less confidence. And if you ask why are they having less confidence, well, you just read the news. See this, but the U.S. is turning itself into a banana republic by going deeper and deeper in debt to try and bail out the people that got caught in the speculation in the stock market or the speculation in real estate, and at the same time it's lost its manufacturing capability. And you'll see when you look at the emerging market funds that they're vastly outperforming the U.S. So the United States is just sort of sliding into a hole. Well, that's part of the cycle, and eventually it will get cheap enough to bump themselves. But when you're sliding, the P/E ratios drop. So if somebody says the earnings are going to be 10% better, yeah, but the confidence level goes down 10%, you still can't do anything. That's why you get these trading range tops to go in. They're eventually figuring it out. Of course, none of this has anything to do with timing. It's just mostly in the because it's based on the Graham and Dodd in the 30s. They're the people that wrote the book on the fundamental analysis, and its biggest proponent is of that sort of a category is Warren Buffett. And so we'll switch to the next thing. Is in my matrix I have the people that I think that were really, really good, and we generally calculate their annual rate of returns. I mean, the rate of returns going back for as long as we can, but we're not interested in anything before 2000 because what happened is the situation has drastically changed. And when you look at the and I have to get my spreadsheets oriented correctly here, to the summary, the person that if you're basically in this business, which we're in this business, you know, what you have to do is you have to kind of look at the 5-year rate of return. That is, after all the costs are taken out of it, when you look at it, and you look at the people that are really, really good, that have like 40-year reputations, the person that I think is probably the best one is Jean-Marie Evillard, a Frenchman who has a great 40-year record but is now retiring. Or you have to go to Berkshire Hathaway with Warren Buffett, who is also 40 years, a great record, and is retiring, and make sure that you kind of know what their 10-year averages were, rate of returns. But specifically to track things, you generally do it at the five-year average because it covers the 4-year cycle, so you get what they did on the upside, you get to know the downside. So if you look at the First Eagle, the symbol is SGENX. That's a load fund, so we don't ever use it. But his 10-year average is 13%. Warren Buffett's his fund Berkshire Hathaway is BRK.A at his 7%. Problem with Buffett is Buffett's going all over the map with some crazy things, whereas Evillard's 13%. He's always has some gold in his portfolio, and he's income oriented. So he's very conservative. If you look at Fidelity Capital and Income over that 10-year period, it's 10. That's an average of 10%. So that's very good. And if you look at, but if you look over the last 10 years and you look for the top ones, it's Tocqueville Gold at 31%. And GLD at 15%. So GLD can beat anybody on a conservative basis because it's just the World Gold Council set up an ETF with they got the bars hidden someplace. Okay, you get it as a fraction of it. Tocqueville Gold is mining, and it's known, mining gold stocks are known to have a 2-to-1 advantage on leverage. It means they go up to if you're in their uptrend, which we have been, they'll do twice as well. But if you ever get caught in a downtrend, they'll do twice as badly. So, you know, if you're conservative, you go with the gold, and if you're aggressive, if you think you have an opportunity, you go with the mining stocks. But if you look at the Tocqueville Gold versus other mining stocks, it's head and shoulders above the others. So if you're just looking at that, now if you go to the 5-year rate of returns, which I have to find all the tables in here, which is more or less what you kind of go for. See, you can look at 40-year records and you can look at 10-year records, but this change is going on, and so the 5 years is more or less what you look at. And in the 5-year category, I would say that we have seen the same relative ranking on the 5-year average. But for Tocqueville Gold, on the 5-year average, that has a 2% load if you don't hold it for over 6 months, is 25.9%. GLD over the last 5 years is 22%. Vanguard U.S. Treasury, which is the VUSTX, is 6.7%. If you take an intermediate-term bond fund, it's 5.8%. So the question, and you get less headaches. So maybe instead of going for 6.7%, you want less headaches, you go down to 5.8% is respectable return. When you consider that the S&P 500 has basically got problems, that's 3.7%, and it's very volatile. If you go down to FAGEX, it's 9.6%. If you go back to First Eagle, it's 8%. And if you go to Berkshire Hathaway, we're at 6%. So First Eagle, Eagle Eye's philosophy is probably better. And capital income is never to be downcounted if you can get, which is a JNK in terms of the money flow indicators, if you've got that kind of a situation. If you get, and then if you go to, let's see, if you take the average for ASIC 5% average, and then you subtract the management fee from that, it's a little bit over 10%. So that basically is competitive with the it's competitive with the other people, but it's not competitive with gold. Okay, so you always want to latch on to gold if you can find a reasonable case for it, because it drags your average up. Now, moving down on the when you look at the bonds, what you do is, if you look at the bonds in the years 2000, 2001, 2002, all the way up to 2010, you find out, and you relate them against the S&P 500, you find out that if you are in an up year, you always want to be in a high yield bond fund. VAGIC is the one we use, but JNK would be fine too. If you are in a down year, in retrospect, you would always want to be into a federal, treasury bond fund. But if you look at the year to date, we're 11 months through the year, because this is at the end of the month, and you look at the various bonds. Now, when we do best bond, we actually look at like a huge number of bonds, probably 15 bonds here, and the ones, if you look at inflation protected, the ones that you might think of, okay, is inflation protected bonds for the 11 months of the year are 7.6%. If you look at the Vanguard U.S. Treasury VAGIX, it's about 13%. If you look at the Ginnie Mae bond funds, at 7.8%. If you look at the Vanguard Intermediate Bond Fund, which is VFITX, it's 9.8%. So it's got less headaches in it. So that, there's an option always to come down on that one. If you look at Fidelity Short-Term Bond Fund, that's about 4%. And if you want inflation protected bonds, that's 7.5%. That's perfectly respectable. If you go into short term treasuries, you get to 3%, and that's sort of the equivalent to the money market fund. But as soon as you start going into golds and metals, you start typically there. Fidelity has a fund that's up 30% year to date, but Tocqueville Gold is up 50.7%. Now, you can get out of the commission problem, redemption fees on Fidelity at 30%, or you can take the chance that you can't hold it for 6 months because your money flow fees won't go that far, and take a 2% charge. But at 50% per annum versus 30% per annum, if you got a long-term opportunity, you always take that, because maybe it'll keep going. Usually what happens, you have a mixture. Some of them you've held for a while, and some of them you haven't held, so it's sort of a mixture. Convertible securities, one of the things that we did, we studied convertible securities too, and convertible securities have a 9% average 10-year fund, but capital income is better than that. But if you know that you're in an up year, convertible securities can be another option. To simplify matters, we just went with two categories. The ultra safe and the ultra consistently aggressive ones on the upside, and then we also do things with other areas that would be of interest to you, just to quote them. But you end up with these categories of. And I'll have to give you one more set of categories. And this is I'll just do it for the year today, because the spreadsheet's kind of big. If you look at the let's see. Well, my business partner Paul is always interested in the green funds, the ones that they're trying to do good things. And for 2010, that is up 3%. It was up 37% for the previous year. Alternative energy, which is a similar category, was in 2009 was up 33%. It's down 26%. You don't want to get involved in any of these fad things when you're doing the management, because that there's got to be a problem. Vanguard has a global fund, which means it's all countries, including the United States, up 32%, and then up 7% this year. If you get to the Merck hard currency fund, which would be an alternative, you'd think it would be an alternative to gold, that's MERKX. We have it listed at 14% last year and up 0.5% this year. If you go to the big surprise is that everybody's always thinking, and they're always equating our situation with Japan. If you go to Japan, it was up 15% in 2009, up 5.6% this year. But if you look at the average over the last 10 years, because that has been around for 10 years, it's minus 1%. So that's what the Federal Reserve is worried about. If we go the way that Japan is going to go, you just can't make any money. You know, I mean, it's a bad case. The other one I have to talk about, the other ones that are respectable funds are emerging market funds. Emerging market funds is up 16%. It's up 11%, almost 12% this year. It's up 76% the year, but it was down 60% in 2008. So you got to kind of worry about whether you want to do anything. The real crazy one is ING Russia A. Okay, it's down 71% in 2008. It's up 129% for this year. It's up 14% this year, and its 10-year average is up 13%. The problem with that fund is that fund is completely crazy. It goes all over. And you've got a whole bunch of that stuff. The China fund, which is probably the sanest of the other ones, is the other interesting category, which I'll just wind up with. And that's the Matthews China fund, with very competent people, 18% for this year, has a 24% average compound growth, but it's still less than the gold. So our purpose is we always latch onto the gold. That's why we don't do money flow indicator on the. But that would be a good case to do that, or an emerging market fund, because it's basically a U.S. The problem is the U.S. But they get dragged down, because if you look at Matthews China, it was down 48% in 2008. It's hard to get invested long term in something that's going down that long. Oh, did a terrific job in 2009, and it's doing okay now, and it has a good average. If we find a money flow indicator on it, but you have to find an exchange traded fund to do that. So that would be a pretty good way. So that's pretty much what the story is. And so when you look at the whole matrix combination, is that if they like something, we just go for the gold, because the gold will beat anybody that we can find, and it's you only have to do one money flow indicator T on it. You could branch out in the other ones, but I don't think that they're probably that there's much sense in doing that. So I hope that answers the questions. Now, doing all this thing, there's the problems with loads and there's redemption fees and so forth. What we do is, in our program, we take all that out and subtract the management fees, the redemption fees, and they're all accounted for. But when you look at some of these funds, if you've got to have a fund that's going to have a 5% load, you really can't change it. And if you're going to hold it, but you could probably take 1% off for each year, or if you're going to have a five-year holding period or something like that. That's what you have to do to kind of even things out. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about it in the funds, just to provide you with an answer to the question. So we have this big matrix, and we're always studying that, and we don't like to have the other thing that we don't do is we cut off losses by means of a criteria. That is, if you enter a trade, if you have a loss, you a certain amount, you cut it off. If you have gains, we also cut it off coming back. because we don't want to have the ultimate embarrassment of having a big gain and return into a loss. So you have to put some arbitrary rules on that. Parker has a saying at his site: what you're looking for is a way to get good gains with very small losses. Okay, that generally works out right for the long term, because eventually you've got to run into a disaster stage, and even now you have the fact that the PA ratio is likely to go down under 10. That's a disaster. And you don't even have to lose the earnings; you just have to lose confidence. You lose confidence, then you lose the PE ratio. Okay, so that winds up this section, and then we'll be back and we'll take care of the most microscopic look, which is in the short range T.